Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. For everyone else watching this outside of the country, we are in Bucharest now. I'm a Romanian vlogger, and here with me in the studio is Orest Zub, an Ukrainian one. Nice to meet you, Orest.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Orest is such an interesting name, and I understand it's very rare in Ukraine.
It actually comes from Greek. You know, there is a mythology, and one of the superheroes in Greek mythology is Orest, along with many other legendary personalities. And somehow this name came to Ukraine.
Okay.
And my parents decided to use this to name me, and I'm very grateful for that, actually.
So we are here with Orest. He's traveling around the world, and now he's in Romania for a series of events. He was able to spare some time to come and talk to us, to me, and to our audience about his home country, where you have your base in Ukraine, but you're like an international citizen now, from what I understand. So you're based in Lviv?
So I'm native to Lviv, yes, which is a city in western Ukraine. I was born there, grew up. But since the last at least 10 years, since my early 20s, I started traveling around the world to see it, to understand it better, and what I really like to do. At the moment, I visited over 120 countries. So I have in what to compare, right? And when the war in Ukraine was about to start, I was on the road as well. However, I felt...
Where were you?
I was in Karabakh, in the Caucasus Mountains, you know, which is another conflict zone. And I've seen the results of the war. I've seen the scale of devastation, the ruined cities. And, you know, the entire world was already screaming that Russia will attack. So I just took the flight, and 4 days before the actual invasion, I came back to Ukraine to stay with my people and my family and to do everything I can to participate in our resistance.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the resistance and the war and everything, but we're going to try and keep it a little, let's say, more relaxed as much as possible. Because at the time we are talking, we need to admit that there are people dying every hour. We could say that.
It's true. The casualties are very bad. So our officials tell that approximately 100-150 soldiers die every day in the east, in Donbas area. Civilians are not confirmed, but also daily there are civilian casualties. And it looks like we are facing the military conflict with the largest death toll after World War II, unfortunately.
Yes, it's confirmed. And we just heard this week that it's going to go on for some time from now on. And everybody's asking, okay, how long? I'm not so sure you can answer this question, but at this time, from what I see, the Ukrainians are holding. They are holding fast to this. And I can see from you, from your attitude, and from everyone else that I'm talking to, that you're not backing down.
Oh, absolutely not. And I mean, that's the only thing what we can do, right? If it's the question live or die, you do everything to survive. And what's the most amazing in all of this story, now we are already almost 4 months into war, yeah?
So,
but if you remember the very beginning of it, after the full-scale invasion with the massive missile attack and land invasion with tanks and artillery, the entire world was watching and thinking, how long Ukraine can hold on? Everybody were counting like 5 days, 1 week, 2 weeks, but Ukraine stand still. The world start to help. The entire north part of the country is liberated, meaning it fought back after 1 month of occupation. And the biggest combat now is happening on the east with a very, very little progress. And in other areas, Ukrainian army is fighting back, actually reclaiming the territory. So we are getting stronger. The world is uniting behind Ukraine. And nobody would expect this for only 4 months ago. And now we see that the victory is possible. The question is that, obviously, what will be the price for this victory? But that's the only thing we can do right now.
From what you're saying, when you heard the conflict is going to start, the first thing you did was go back home to Lviv and witness and be and try and help. You're actually an ambassador for the city. You're traveling the world. And on behalf of the city, you're not hired or paid. But you're doing this for your country. So how do you make this kind of decision that I'm going to go back and fight? And then you put on this t-shirt with a very clear message to everyone that wants to listen. But that's not just a Russian warship over there, isn't it? What's on top of the warship?
On top there's a star and there is Kremlin.
Oh, so on top of the Russian warship there's a Kremlin. Okay. Mm-hmm. Nobody thought that you could take on Kremlin in February.
Well, nobody thought many other things, right? But that's the true fact. Ukraine resists. Ukraine is much stronger than people thought. And Russian second military in the world is actually not that strong as people see. So this definitely can change the course of the history. And now seeing the results, what have been done before with all the support and now Ukraine being at the doorstep of European Union integration, we see that actually by fighting this war, we are protecting not only ourselves, but also Ukraine is functioning effectively as the shield of the entire free world. And those are the principles that are worth striving for. And developing with your question, like, why did I decide to come, for example? It's hard to explain why do you defend your country. Like, what would you do if somebody crashed into your home? Of course, you can just go and, you know, change living in another city, knowing that somebody is living in your home. But a normal person would do is to stay in their home and protect it. That's the natural. It depends on the people. And that because of this, Ukraine is resisting. Because of that, Ukraine is actually was able to fight much stronger army. And for me personally, there were a few decisions. And as I told, it was very clear for me because I was traveling around the world for the last over than 10 years. And if you remember, in 2014, Ukraine was living through the revolution, which actually started the war. So I would want to remind you that this phase is just the most aggressive part of the war. Of but the war is happening since 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea and started the war in Donbass. And during that time, I was traveling in Mexico. Mm-hmm. You know, like living a digital nomad life, working from my computer, doing some marketing campaigns and so on. And being so far from the events, I felt so helpless. I felt so bad just watching everything online.
Okay.
So this time, anticipating the events, I knew that I will do everything in my power to participate. And this feeling was even strengthened with the fact that I was in Karabakh just 1 week before the invasion. So I've seen the result of the brutal war with the destroyed cities. And it's one feeling when you are like a visitor somewhere and you see it. But when it's happening to your own country, it's a totally different feeling. So
really?
Absolutely.
Because one of the first of the initial responses from the Romanians, and not only Romanians, to be honest, is, where the hell do we run to? Because we need to run out of here. If the Russians come, where do we run to?
It is very natural approach. Yeah. So regarding the feelings, I thought, okay, I will come back to Ukraine, the war will start and we will do everything we can. Yes. But if you remember this night of February 24, when over 70 missile long-range attack happening all around the country, and Ukraine is almost three times the size of Romania, and you can imagine that entire country was covered with attacks, this created a massive panic. Millions of people started to move around, you know, get cash from the ATM, buy toilet paper, water, travel by cars from east to west. The country was paralyzed. And this is a normal reaction of a living human being if there is a physical threat on you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't know what to expect. Everybody was thinking that the next missile will come straight to you. And I had this feeling as well. But after a couple of days, when your mind starts thinking more rationally, you understand that most probably you're not going to die in the next 1 hour or two. You start taking action. You know, like with our team from marketing perspective, we changed to producing English language war-related content. Some restaurants, they open up again to start cooking food for the militaries. Some textile companies, instead of making jeans, they start produce military trousers, and so on and so forth. Yes, the entire economy is restructuring towards the war needs, because everybody feels and understands that they have to make the contribution. And
but how do you make such a decision? Because to decide, I'm not going to run away, I'm going to stand up and fight, or just support the war, is not an easy decision. Okay, Ukraine is a very large country. We've seen people displaced, moving outside the country, but they're still a minority. The most Ukrainians are still inside Ukraine.
Oh, of course, most are inside in Ukraine, yeah. So far, over 7 million people left Ukraine, mostly women and children, including my mother, two of my sisters, and my nephew. They left Ukraine in the first week, but now they are back, luckily. So our families...
They are back?
Yes, they are back.
How did they make such a decision to come back?
Once your mind starts functioning rationally and you understand that Russian tanks are not going to roll in your city in 2 days, and when the geography matters, so the progress is going not far, not so fast as everybody thinks, many events become more predictable. For example, you understand that if the fight is 1,000 kilometers away, it means in your city you can go to the shop and buy food and most probably nothing will happen, right? So this creates the understanding that this is safer, and I can come back just to be with my family, you know, to continue living, because this is war, but there are normal processes happening. You know, the economy has to function. People have to go to the hairdresser. Children have to study and so on and so forth. Yeah. So actually, starting from the middle of May, there have been reported that more people cross into Ukraine than out of Ukraine. And my family was among a few. Mm-hmm. If you take a look on the map and you draw a line in the middle of Ukraine, let's say between Kyiv and Odessa, everything west is functioning more or less properly with the public transport, with city services, with the financial institutions and so on.
More or less, because from what I'm hearing, there's a very big strain on transportation. There's a lot of trucking companies in my country that are being called upon to try and help transport grains and stuff like that. And from what I'm hearing, it's not easy going through Ukraine.
There is shortage of petrol at the moment. So every time, like during my recent humanitarian trip to the Croatia, on the way back in Hungary, I completely refilled my tank in the car. And I brought extra 60 liters of petrol in the barrels to give one for my father and to one for my brother-in-law, so we are not stuck. But it's still possible to get petrol, even though it's like in a shortage. Public transport is operating. All the city services are operating. Internet is operating. And the more you move to the east, the more different it gets. So, for example, Kyiv now is getting back to life after it was besieged. I personally visited the deoccupied areas in the north of Ukraine within days after they were liberated. So I was in Bucha. I've seen the people. I've seen when they were taken out. When I was traveling in this area, I still felt the ash, you know, the heat from the buildings that were just burned down. I spoke to people in the villages who lived for 1 month during the Russian occupation, listened to their stories as well. You know, there are a lot have been told already, but there were many, many reports and confirming cases of the military crimes as well. So that's unfortunately what we are facing now. And my next trip, once I'm back in Ukraine, I'll go to the east, and I'm afraid to see there much more these violent cases. However, as I told you, yes, the borders are open. Logistics is functioning, even though with some delays.
So if I put into my head that I want to get to Kyiv, I could do that.
Absolutely. You go from here, you go to Chernihiv. And from Chernihiv, you take a train and you go to Kyiv and you buy the ticket online. As easy as that.
Would you recommend that?
It depends on you. If you're asking me about would you recommend do this because it's safely safe or not, I would tell yes. So this is the important thing you should understand about the safety. everybody thinks, okay, Ukraine is at war and there are like fights all around the country. But there are actually not. I'm going to show you now the app just for you to have better understanding. It's a good website to track the military action. liveuamap.com. So take a look at this map.
Okay. So I'm looking at liveuamap.com.
Yeah. And here is the interactive map with the hourly updates about the war and so on. Yeah. So everything where is red, it's the front line where main the combat is happening. So think of from that area to Lviv, to my native city, is around 1,000 kilometers. It's the same distance. It's more than from Bucharest to my city.
Yes.
It's more than from my city to Frankfurt. In the north, you can see a gray area. This is the one which was under occupation for 1 month, but now is liberated.
Mm-hmm.
And regarding safety option. So Lviv is the city in the west, yes? We received some long-range missile attacks from the Russian territory or Black Sea area. There were like three different attacks on the city, mostly targeting military objects. Mm-hmm. Some of them targeted civilian objects. But during the entire war, during the 4 months, there were six war-related casualties in Lviv. So more people die in a traffic accident, yes? And the biggest destruction, like this what you see on the TV or that media is showing, this is only possible when the land artillery is approaching the city for distance 25 kilometers. That's when they have the enough volume with tanks, with, yes, with go-beats, yeah, that they can shoot and destroy the sections of the city. With the long-range missiles, there are only a few of them to use them to destroy the city. So they use them to target some strategic objects, like a railway station, like the oil refinery, yes? But this terrible destruction, what you've seen in Bucha, in Irpin, Borodyanka, and what is happening in the east of Ukraine, this is happening because of the actual fight or because of the actual land artillery shelling.
Of course, and tanks that are
and tanks
within,
and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this you can predict because they cannot move 100 kilometers per day. They can.
They cannot, because Romanians live with the fear that Russians could be in Bucharest in a few hours.
That's not simply not possible because of the reasons I explained to you, yeah? As the one being in Ukraine. When the attack was unexpected, they came like 50 kilometers per day, yes? And now when it's actually the fight is happening and there is a front line, you know, they move one village per day maximum, which is like 1-2 kilometers per day. It's not possible to move faster. And even if they move faster, it's all transparent. You know, you have the radars and TV and press is everywhere. So it's now it's pretty predictable, at least in terms of gaining or losing the territory.
Okay.
And from this perspective, visiting the city, which is let's say 100 kilometers away from the front line, is from the physical standpoint is as safe as, you know, any other place.
Because Ukraine was becoming a very international, let's say, place, country. Mm-hmm. Lviv was already a touristic destination.
Mm-hmm.
European famous city, let's say, almost. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of attraction towards Ukraine, but still, hearing about the war is not very motivating and it's not going to be anytime soon.
Of course, I understand this.
But I'm going to come back to the people living there.
Mm.
We from the distance, we are not there yet. I hope we never will be. But we are looking at the Ukrainians and we think, what are these guys made of that they can take all this beating, all this war? And now they even go back into that country where there is a war going on. Because I don't know if you heard about this, but even the Swiss fear a war with Russia, and some of them were thinking about running to New Zealand. Maybe it's safer there. So in the face of war, most of the people, first thing that comes to mind, okay, where am I running to? But Ukrainians are not running away and the resistance is very strong. So I'm trying to understand, where do you get all that strength? Where does it come from?
I'm sure that most of the Romanians would do the same if the same situation happened in your country. God forbid this to happen, but your people would do absolutely the same. I'm sure in that.
Okay, what's the primal motivation?
Yeah, the primal. So
is it you love your country, you love your family, you love your house, or you hate the Russians?
Okay, so let's assume, God forbid, something is happening around Bucharest. You are well-established person over here.
Yes.
You have an amazing life. Your colleagues are here. You have this beautiful studio. All your life, all your business, everything what you build up during your lifespan is here.
Yes.
And you tell like, okay, so now what? I go and I fly to Spain. Okay, you can buy a house in Spain. Mm. You will sit there, you live with this house, and what? You'll be watching Romania to suffer? Or what you will do? Like, did you think of like what you will do if you change?
I never thought about this because I got this question and my answer was pretty simple. My whole life is here. I'm not going anywhere.
Correct. Even in modern globalized world, still you are pretty attached. And on another side, from this, like in addition to this personal approach, there is like, I mean, we are dealing with pure evil at the moment. And this entire situation, from the micro perspective, you have a human life, you value this so much, yes? But on a larger scale, this is the life story of all the movies, all the myths, all the sagas we heard all our life. When
yeah, but those are movies.
Goliath,
come on,
is fighting against the
David. That's a small guy. The small guy against the big guy.
You see, so that's the true example of this story that our civilization is actually built on.
No, it's not that simple, because death is real.
Yeah,
and David knows he can be crushed, and guess what? Some people get crushed.
It's true,
every day.
Yeah.
So how do you live with that? Because from what I'm hearing, I don't know if you heard about this, but there's people saying if anyone on earth, if any nation on earth was supposed to fight the Russians, that would be the Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm gonna try one more time.
Again.
What are you made of?
Like, there is a quote, I think you can find some t-shirts like this, like, don't worry, be Ukrainian, you know? So nowadays, Ukrainian is not only a nationality, but this is a state of mind. And if you ask me for another, like, motivation, all grandfathers of all of my friends were fighting against Russians after World War II until the end of 50s.
Really?
And their grandfathers were like sent to Siberia and they were coming back. And then some of their family member was killed. Then they're like, their mothers were not allowed to speak Ukrainian language in school. And this was happening for 300 years in the past. So now we understand that this is the best possible time to change the course of that history, which was working towards eliminating Ukrainian nation for so many centuries. And now this is the chance for our nation to become stronger and eventually unite with the rest of European community and with the rest of the Western civilized world. That's what we are feeling for. And this is also a bright future for the further generations living in Ukraine.
So you're a sacrifice generation.
I hope we will not have to sacrifice everybody, but the history shows that freedom is not free and it's necessary to fight for it. You know, the same as Romanians were fighting in the 19th century, you know, when Wallachia, Moldova were united and you started to
produce. You know much more about Romanian history than most of the Romanians know about Ukrainian history.
Mm-hmm.
And that says something, but still I'm going to go back to this. So when I'm listening to you, I hear about an Ukrainian national talking about his nation that he wants liberated from the Russian boot and wants to join the European Union as an European country. And from where we stand, there's whole this narrative about the war and the David versus Goliath and everything, but there's this underlying story. I don't know if you heard about this underlying story that is, let's say, fomenting in the social media, in some groups, in some places, where they say, oh, come on, these Ukrainians, they are Russians too. Have you heard about this?
I mean, there are different rumors, and it needs more explanation, obviously, but this is simply not true. Because Ukrainian language is different than Russian language. It's actually much...
Sounds the same. For a Romanian guy, it sounds the same. I'm just triggering.
Yeah. It's okay.
But there's a lot of people that are starting to say this with the you know, around we say in Romanian around corners.
Mm-hmm.
Say, ah, come on, these Ukrainians, they're Russians too.
Mm-hmm.
Who else could fight a Russian? Another Russian. But of course, this is not the mainstream narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But it's building up.
Really. I think the events what we are seeing now clearly shows, and I mean, I don't have to prove that I am Ukrainian, not a Russian. I have nothing to prove here because I am Ukrainian, and even the fact that Russia is doing everything possible to eliminate Ukrainians tells this up front. Why would they even try to do this? Because they feel this is danger for their empire. And the only way for empire to continue existing is to getting new and new lands, controlling those territories. So basically, it's not something has to be proved if we are at war at the moment. So brother is not visiting brother this way, isn't it?
Some people say that Ukrainians have relatives, have family in Russia, and come on, they are all related.
Oh, definitely we are related because there are many international families. Yes, during the Soviet Union, people were mixed a lot. There are many relatives who living in northern Romania who has relatives in Ukraine, and this is a natural situation in Europe where so many people are living in a small period of land. Yes, for example, my grandparents, all of my four grandparents, they were born in the present areas where is Poland, because mm-hmm. the borders were different back then before the World War II.
No, there were no borders, no physical borders. We invented those physical borders mm-hmm. like less than two centuries ago. So people were traveling everywhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is like, it's normal that there are families all around, yes. But that's what we are facing now.
If we are to be honest,
yeah,
we are much more similar than we are different. Much more similar between us, even Romanians with Ukrainians, even though our languages are so different.
Mm-hmm.
If we are to be honest, to go to the extreme honesty, we are very similar to Russians too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we are very
similar. It depends how deep you go. It's also an interesting question for a conversation. At the what layers you go? Like, exactly. Are you talking at the layers of species?
Okay.
Or you're talking in the language or in the level of Caucasian race?
Yes.
Or if you're talking at the level Balkans. Of Eastern European or Balkans or Slavic and so on. So
we have da in Romanian. We are a Latin country, but we mm-hmm. say for yes, we say da. And when we go abroad, people think we are Russians. When Romanians speak English, it sounds like Russian.
Oh, you see?
So people think we're Russians. We're not Russians. We're Romanian. We're Latin.
Correct. Yeah. That's the answer to your question.
But I want to dig deeper into this.
Yes.
Bucharest is very funny. It's a very hot city, but it can also be very cold because we have the Russian krivats. The wind from Russia blows in the winter.
You have a special name for it, krivats.
Krivats, yes.
Oh, interesting. In Croatia, which is another very similar country to our area, yes, and there is a lot of in common. For example, it was part of Austro-Hungarian Empire during Western Ukraine, Northwestern Romania and Croatia. And they have the name Bura, which is a specific name for the wind which blows only in winter from the mountains to the sea, you know, so...
Yes, we have the wind coming from the east. And it mm-hmm. blows cold and is nasty. You cannot, mm-hmm. cannot do anything here. I'd rather be in the mountains where there's no wind.
Mm.
Let's go back.
Yeah.
So I was talking about how similar we are physically, genetically, historically, let's say from a species or a race or anything else
mm-hmm.
physically. But we grow... so different from one another.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this is how we can say, okay, we are Romanians because a set of things, and then we are Croatian because a set of things. We are Bulgarians, although we are very similar to the Bulgarians. but we seem to fight a lot about this. I don't know why. But then there's this very, very similar. If you put a Ukrainian person and a Russian person in the same room, let's say from mostly from the Muscovy, from the Moscow area or St. Petersburg, very similar. What's so different and where from this?
Like there is a possible to divide, to differ in the fundamental way. Ukrainians were always free-spirited people. So we were always like organizing historically into communities, having some council, deciding together. And if we don't like, we revolt. That's why there was the Orange Revolution in 2004 when the present elections were faked. Ukrainians went on the street. I was 17 years old. I was there. Then when our government changed perspective from the European to Eastern, we had the Euromaidan Revolution. That's where we revolt. And that's why when in this very hard situation, when you are attacked by a much stronger armor, people stand up and we do what we do. And that's the Ukrainian spirit. The Russian mentality goes very deep into subordinate authoritarian rule. So there is a statement, faith into the Tsar. So the Russian society, they always follow one strong person, you know, at the very top. Ukrainians are built up from the bottom. And that goes very deep into mentality. They don't revolt.
Yes.
The Tsar in Russia is going for the last, what, over than 20 years at the moment. Mm-hmm. In Ukraine, we have a new president every 5 years. And this is the fundamental difference. Ukrainians are liberal, democratic, Western-oriented society. Russians are people who need one strong leader who will lead them. And that makes a very, very big difference in the deep into mentality of those two nations, if I can explain this way.
Okay, that sounds very nice, almost romantic. But Ukraine is a bit far, it's a little far from this. Okay, I understand the structure and everything. There's a long way to go to go into the European Union. You've seen even in the hot-blooded moments of the war, all European leaders were okay. Let's stop and take some time and talk about it before we receive Ukraine into the European Union, because there are some differences. There are some things to fix there. But mostly the what you've told me about these communities. That's grassroots, actually. Yeah, working around communities goes much deeper. It's also geography there. You had to organize like this. There was no other way. Mm-hmm. Ukraine is a very large country, and you're doing a lot of agriculture. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me more about this? Because I'm very curious to understand.
So definitely, Ukrainians are historically a farmers, and 1/3 of the world black earth, which is the most rich earth to grow crops, is within Ukraine. Yeah, so very naturally, Ukrainians are farmers. Ukrainians were not big warriors. You know, we never initiated an occupying war. It was the country that was always protecting themselves and their people. And we are very friendly. Like, we never initiated an aggressive war. That's why, historically, you know, Ukrainians were dealing with the land and somebody else was dealing with administration, like Poles, like Lithuanians, like Austrians, and so on. Even during the late 19th century, when there was a large waves of immigration to the like transatlantic countries like United States and Canada, Ukrainians were invited to prairies to work on the land. And at some provinces of Western Canada, like Alberta and Saskatchewan, up to 25% of modern population has Ukrainian roots. Mm-hmm. That's a fact. So this also goes deeply, yes, that we are gathered around communities, we do the farming, and we don't really, you know, we don't need to conquer other lands. But once you have this kind of situation, I mean, you cannot fight with the shuffle, right? You need something else, or at least you take the shuffle and you fight with the shuffle. But that's the last what we have. We are standing on
if
our land.
If you have
land,
a tractor, you can transport a tank.
Yeah, you can take a tank and which will serve on your farm as well. So like, that's the...
Can you?
People do it.
Is it any good?
Well, it can take some heavy machineries up and down. Also, it can stand there. You know, some people put this fake person to protect from the crowds, and here you put a tank to protect from the Russians not to approach. So that definitely makes sense. Yeah.
Okay. Coming back to the crops, I was telling you about you're telling me about let's say the. We call them in Romanian Cernozem. Cernozem, the good earth for all that. And from what I'm reading, almost 1 in 5 calories that the planet is consuming come from your area, Poland and Russia. But mostly Poland, Ukraine and Russia. And Ukraine is the biggest exporter of wheat and other cereals. Is it true that what I'm hearing, that half of the crop for 2022 is not gonna be, let's say, harvested?
Well,
what's happening there? Because it's harvest time now.
Okay, so first of all, is that most of the warehouses in Ukraine now are full with the previous year crop? Yes, and because of the blockade in the Black Sea, it's simply not possible to ship it. That's where Romania can be a good partner, and I know now there are some huge developments in Constanța port to be able to process such big volumes. Secondly, we have to understand that at the moment 20% of Ukrainian territory is occupied by Russia. That's more than 20% of agricultural lands of Ukraine, because we are talking about the south and east, which are agricultural lands. Yeah, so it's definitely, we can assume it will, like, the farming production will go down up to 50% nationwide. But it's still happening. You know, I have a friend who lives in Lozova. Lozova, this is a town in Kharkiv Oblast, which is only 50 kilometers from Izum, which is already under occupation. I was in a constant touch with him all the time. He's my good friend, and he has a family business, which is a farm that his father built, started 20 years ago. And he tells me, like, Orest, you know, I hear the explosions all the time from 30, 40 kilometers, but we are still working on the land because we have to take the harvest from autumn, from like this winter harvest. Otherwise, if I don't do this, entire company that my father built will collapse in 1 second. So I'm driving my car, I'm driving a tractor, like 20% of our team is here, the rest with their families are in Western Ukraine. And in my car, I have all the belongings I need to evacuate. So if there is a physical threat right now, I sit in the car and I go. Otherwise, we will continue working. You know, and they actually managed to get the first harvest. They also planted the seed for the summer harvest, and they keep operating. Like, I cannot tell it's a new normal, but that is a new reality that we have to adjust. The same as, you know, Israel is adjusting. They are always at the constant alert, but they keep functioning. And these are the conditions that we have to work on somehow.
It's a new reality, but it's not nowhere near normal.
Absolutely not. But
sounds crazy.
It does. It does sound crazy. I also remember myself when during the first month of the invasion, with the constant airstrike alarms, even in Lviv, you know, you go in the street and you start having this like, woo, you know, and people start going to the basements of the building just to hide. The restaurants close down, you know, some people don't pay attention, they continue walking on the street. And then when the alarm is out or the missile being shot somewhere in the sky, okay, the restaurant is back to normal, they start serving food again. For the first 3 weeks, I was sleeping with my wife in the corridor, which is protected by two walls from the street. In case there's explosion, there is some protection. For the first time, we were going down to the basement during the airstrike alarm. And now people got so used to it, they don't pay attention to this anymore, which is crazy. However, I mean, there were cases when because somebody didn't take a shelter, he was killed. Yeah. So it's definitely important to take it seriously. And obviously, the closer you are to the front line, the more threat it gets.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So people even stop caring about the fact that they could be hit by a missile.
Oh, absolutely. Like once...
That's so Ukrainian.
I tell you personally, after a couple of, like, let's say after what, like 2-3 weeks of waking up 2-3 times per night, running down to the basement and up, I told, like, fuck it, sorry. I'm not going to
live. Hui.
I'm not going to live like this anymore. You know, I'm not a rat to go up and down all the time. I want to, you know. So after like 3 weeks, I told to my wife, like, okay, now I'm coming back to my bed, even though we live in the corner building. So we simply put tape on the windows. But I tell her, like, I'm going to sleep like
tape
a human.
Four shards, so no shards are flying off the window in case of
Yeah, you just put tape, so, you know, so it has at least some kind of protection from the wave and so on.
Okay. Duct tape or scotch tape?
Scotch. Yeah, just put scotch and that's it.
Just put scotch, come on, no problem.
Yeah, and I told her, like, you know, honey, I'm going to live like a human on the bed. If you want... Because you were more stressed, you can stay in a yeah. corridor. I sleep on the bed for 2 nights. I was sleeping on the bed, slept very well, and then she joined me back. And you know, and that's yeah, that's.
What and life goes on.
Yeah,
normally,
as normal as it can get. However, I can assure you, it's much more normal than you think from here, because people tend to worry on a distance always much more than on the spot itself.
Okay, so I'm going.
So I invite you to Lviv, seriously.
Okay, I'll come.
Yeah, please.
Okay, why not?
Angelina Jolie, all the Boris Johnson and other people have been visiting us frequently recently.
I've only once been to Ukraine, to Kryvyi Rog, like a century ago, something like that.
That's the birthplace of Zelensky, actually. Our current president. This is his hometown.
Okay. So when I last traveled there, the roads were very bumpy.
Now they improved. Since 2014, there have been a lot of reforms in Ukraine, and it's really improved. However, Kryvyi Rih is a very special city. It's the huge iron mining
city. Of course, we know
city,
that.
You know, yeah.
Romania has invested a lot there and okay. lost some hundred million in the process, but that's a very long story.
It is also one of the longest cities in Europe. It spans 430 kilometers.
And the boulevard downtown is huge.
Yeah.
It's very wide. Yeah. Interesting place. They even had Pacanele when I was there. Like everywhere there was gambling, even in the bus station. Do you still have gambling everywhere?
No, it's forbidden already. Yeah, so it's...
You did.
Yeah.
We didn't. We have it everywhere now. Not in the street, but almost. Anyway, let's go back to the... I'm not trying to be... To cringe here.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of men watching this. So I'm gonna put it out there. And you can answer if you want. Does war improve or affects sex life?
I think in the very beginning, it really affects in a negative way because all your subconscious like attention and resources go toward the survival needs. But eventually, you know, our grandfathers used to have sex during World War II somehow. People were giving birth.
Okay.
And the same is happening now. So first, like, your body and your mind start functioning on the, like, life-saving mode. Then secondly, you start having this kind of euphoria and you start tasting the life much better because you value this so much.
I heard about this.
And that's where the sex probably is getting also much better because you do it as the last time or close to it. So spiritually, you're very high at this moment, yes?
Because you feel alive.
Yeah, and you feel alive much, much different way than feeling alive in a normal situation.
You know how they say, it hits different.
Yeah, yeah. And then it becomes normal.
I'm going to feel sorry for you after that because the PTSD is going to kick in, but let's take our time.
Yeah.
So there is also some sense of normal in all the new reality. It becomes a new normal, not only a new reality. Mm-hmm. You adjust.
Yeah.
Can I ask you something about Ukrainian girls?
Sure.
There's a bunch of them on Romanian Tinder. Did you hear?
Tinder is the most popular dating platform in the world, so I would assume that.
But there's a whole lot of them in Romania. Do you know? I have friends that tell me. I didn't do my research. I asked some friends that mm-hmm. I'm married.
Yeah.
So they said there's a lot of interesting Ukrainian women on Romanian Tinder. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot of Ukrainians that went out of the country. But is there anything special we should know about Ukrainian women? How should we treat a Ukrainian woman so she feels... Mm-hmm. I don't know. Well treated.
So first of all, you should understand that, as I told before, like around 7 million Ukrainians left the country. Yeah. 90% out of those are women and children. So we can assume that around 4 million women left the country. That creates a different disproportion in Europe for the amount of beautiful Ukrainian women. And some of the women are single. That's normal, right? And when the woman is single in another country, you know, they'll start looking for friends and so on. This is an absolutely normal situation, and Tinder is a good platform to meet new people and dating and so on. So I would say that, first of all, Ukrainian women are one of the most attractive and beautiful women in the world, among the human yes. species.
Among the human species.
Yes.
So let's, yes, underline.
Yes. I am dating my wife since 2010. We married in 2014, and I feel the luckiest man on earth. And obviously, every woman deserves a proper treatment. Be nice. Open the door ahead of the woman. I would say that Ukrainian woman would expect a man who invite her for a date in a restaurant to pay the bill. That's a normal way.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she's like a Romanian girl. Okay. That's
yeah.
Similar.
That's very normal.
No, that's not normal.
That's the way how we do it.
Come on. If they want equality. No, come on. I'm joking. Come on. Special circumstances,
and the most important rule is the following: like, you know, when you go up and down the stairs, the man always is at the low, like going lower. So if you go down, the man is in the front. When you go up, the man is at the back. Do you know why?
In case someone else comes up, they shouldn't see her first.
Imagine the girl falls. So you have to catch her.
Of course, of course.
But also you can look from the bottom. So
from the bottom, yes.
Yeah. So those were the basic part. But simply don't be the asshole and be a nice person. And the Ukrainian girl will respond to you very well as to.
Any quirkiness, any special things that I shouldn't mention or say, I don't know. Just normal conversation?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. That's just tips for friends.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of men here. They will appreciate with hitting the like button right now for this. Look, I could show you some photos.
Ah, okay.
I love Ukraine. I'm not allowed to watch, but I can appreciate it from afar. So I don't want to cringe too much, and I don't want to become too serious about it. It's a very serious situation. Yeah. We are trying to... let's say, live through it. And it's a long stretch to say make the best of it. But what's good these days? What's normal? How do you make life work beside what we are talking about?
Good is to stay human, to continue being a good person, to provide support where it is needed, to continue following your own principles. And if you are in the privileged position that not many Ukrainians can enjoy at the moment, is maybe not to sacrifice yourself or what you're doing, but maybe adjust your main activity towards Ukrainian need. Yeah. So if there is a company, you can allocate 10% of the employment volume to hire Ukrainians, yeah, or to give them some job. If you produce this kind of amazing videos, you know, pay 5% of your media attention to the Ukrainian question, okay. which will raise the awareness, which will raise the topic. Okay. Yeah. If you do something else in other industry, you know, remember that there is Ukraine, that Ukraine is fighting for your country including, and you can do something a little bit to help us finish this on the preferable conditions for entire humanity and the entire community.
That's one of the reasons you're here, because I'm hearing that people are not paying so much attention these days. There's and it's summer in Europe, there's vacation, people are busy living their own lives.
This is true, unfortunately. So I made one of my publications in my social media, maybe a week or 2 weeks ago, is that after 1 day of war, the interactions in the social media decreased 24 times since the start of the war. On one point, this is a normal human reaction. Something is happening, everybody is buzzing about that. Then it becomes threatening, new normal, adjusting, and so on. Yeah, but I just want to remind you that situation now is actually more dangerous as it used to be in the very beginning. And the combat is much stronger in the east. The fact that Kyiv is besieged is not telling us that the war is over. The combat is stronger now and as it used to be during March.
And
people have to remember it.
The guy in that building over there
is
relying on that piece of information that people don't pay attention after 4 months. They are counting on it.
They are counting on it. It became a marathon instead of the sprint. And we have to keep up with that. Otherwise, piece by piece, we can first lose land, then lose piece of like humanity, and then lose life. So it's already been proven in the history so many times that you cannot let the evil grow. As soon as you see these things, the darkness and these things are getting into like your doorstep, you have to cut it as fast as possible. Otherwise, it is the nature of evil to grow. That's unfortunately we have to face now, and we have to stop it. And the faster, the more efforts we will do now, there are more chances it will not continue and will not spread out.
How do you convince an Ukrainian soldier, your officer, to go to the front line when they know at least 100 people die every day? And those are official numbers. And I'm sure it's fluctuating, of course.
I am not a military expert, but soldiers have orders and they follow the orders. However, if you ask from the humanity part of view, there are more volunteers now in Ukraine who are willing to fight as there are resources in the army to provide them with weapon and the necessary training and equipment.
Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily a war of men versus men, it's machine versus machines.
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, another thing what most people don't realize, it's not like, you know, Napoleonic times when the crowds go and fight. It's more artillery at the moment. It's more artillery, IT, drones. And the most casualties are happening not from the, let's say, snipers or like these like bullets, but most people die from the artillery attacks.
I hear that the Russians are pounding with the artillery. When they start targeting an area, they keep on pounding that area until it becomes rubble. I've seen some photos today of another village and another village leveled.
I've seen this personally. Even in the northern Ukraine, I've seen a few villages that are completely leveled. So you don't really understand where was the street, where was the house.
Yes.
You can see it on my profiles, Instagram and YouTube. I have sections about this. And some areas now in the east of Ukraine, they unfortunately look like a moon surface with craters all around. So that's terrifying. What else can I say? Yeah.
That is. So actually Ukraine needs artillery now, and the people in charge, the president and the foreign ministry and all that, are asking for more arms supply, mostly artillery. And I've seen a piece of video with the Caesar systems from the French that goes in very fast. They shoot and then they move mm-hmm. out because the Russians immediately start hitting back.
Yeah, yeah. The ones they see the source of the attack, that's how the artillery work. Yeah, they detect it and they shoot. And it's not only about the artillery, but even I've heard like a story, for example, that there is a trench. And three soldiers are staying in this trench that they dig by themselves, somewhere closer to the front line, you know, to do some spy work or just to see the situation. And one of them was sitting in the trench and other two guys decide like, okay, let's get out of the trench and smoke. And he's telling them like, guys, and they're like in the middle of the forest, in the bush somewhere. And he tells them like, guys, you have to be in the trench. Nah, we are in the forest, we just smoke, yes. And you know, as soon as it happened, the rocket comes and, you know, two guys are gone. And that one who was in the trench, 3 meters from them, survived. So it's
that's surgical.
It is. It's very precise. It's hard to explain it, but it's you know, this is the war, the first war in the history when so many high technology equipment and tools start being used.
The Russians are using advanced artillery, but also satellites, aviation, drones. What else? What kind of funny, interesting equipment do you hear about the Russians are using?
Like, they rely mostly on the artillery. And
but how do they guide the missiles? Because they need to get that information.
They have drones. The drone gets coordinate, and the artillery, according to this coordinates, they shoot. That's it. Ukrainians started actually what's also impressive in this war is that Ukraine managed to keep the sky because we started to receive a lot of these light like NLAWs and other like rockets that can be shot,
javelins
yes, by the people, and they proved to be so effective that the cost, for example, of one javelin is around $200,000, and they could hit a tank, which is 100 times more, right? So because of this supplies, we managed to fight Russian oppression in the north, which was mostly about the urban war, you know, where you can hide, like you cannot progress so much. But now in the east, where you have the steppe, the open fields, that's the story of like the World War II, when you have the artillery coming and with the huge volume. And in this situation, we need just heavy equipment. Yeah, yeah.
But I've seen some crazy images of the Ukrainians riding on electric motorbikes, mm-hmm. Ukraine made. Mm-hmm. So Ukraine does some of the best electric motorbikes for enduro and stuff like that. Do you know about that?
Yeah.
So they're crazy. They're so fast and they actually look nice. Mm-hmm. And they ride on those with the javelins and the NLAWs, and they ride very fast. They go hit their target and go. Mm-hmm. Because even I've seen a guy operating a drone. They said, we had to learn how to operate the drone that when they see us, we are not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an asymmetrical, like they say, war.
Yeah, yeah. It's they do rotation very fast. It's all about tactics at this moment. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that's like entire science on itself. So you have to train for it, obviously. Mm-hmm.
I hear about also about advanced systems. Some of the guys in the military says that the West is supplying such advanced equipment that when you have some Ukrainian militaries that learn how to use it, after they end their rotation, when the new guys come in, they don't know actually how to use it. Some of them are very sophisticated. Is it getting any better?
You need time for this, yes. So there are reports definitely you need to learn how to use the equipment, and this is imperative to do this. At some situations, it takes even a month to master this or that equipment. This is actually the process which is happening right now. That's why Ukraine is not pushing back as effectively as we would like to be. Because first we had the first phase of the war, then negotiating, then logistics, then training, and then the usage, right? So it takes time. It's not playing the video game, right? It's,
yes. But I've also seen stories about trainers, foreign trainers that go to train Ukrainian fighters or also foreign fighters. There's also this crazy statistic about, some people say it might be true, that Romania has already sent hundreds of mercenaries, like the Russians call them, people that joined the fight. And they said sometimes the problem is medical supply. Not having enough bandages.
The truth is that there are so many requirements. Yes, on February 27th, our president made the open call for the foreign legionaries to come. So, approximately, I believe more than 20,000 foreigners are fighting on the side of Ukraine. I am personally in touch with a few of them, and there was even
Which nationalities?
Taiwan, Croatia, Polish. English, American, yeah. And in terms of medical supply, I mean, there cannot be too much of medical supplies when you are at war. This is one of the biggest requirements they do have, because people, if up to 150 people die a day, you can assume how people get wounded every day. It's like at least 3 or 4 that size. So during my recent trip in Croatia, I established cooperation with very good organization of the former Croatian military officers, that they help Ukraine a lot, especially with medical supplies. And I delivered a bunch of my car, like all of my car with medical supplies to Ukraine. In Lviv, local textile company is making the first aid kits, like packages. And then we get the medical supplies from different countries. There is a list. Actually, this it can be one of the help of your audience. I can provide you with the list.
Yes.
And if there is like somebody involved in the pharmacies, you know, there are like options when the medicine like gets outdated in 3 months, for example, hospitals get rid of it. Please don't get rid. Send it to Ukraine. They will be used within 1 month. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So I delivered this medical to Ukraine, to our humanitarian center. There it was paired in different first aid kits and sent to the front line. Also, there was one legionnaire from Croatia which got wounded in the east of Ukraine. However, it appeared to be that he has some kind of allergy to opium-based tranquilizers. So he could not have a regular surgery, which he had to take. And these guys from Croatia, they gave me this special medicine that he required. The guy on the ambulance was sent from the east to central Ukraine, to town of Vinnytsia in central Ukraine, while I was driving by car to western Ukraine and delivered this the same day. And the next morning he had a surgery with this medical supply. So this is just one example of how many processes are happening in Ukraine. And to like in the 2 days, I'm going to Bulgaria. There I have a setup of a meeting with some of local officials, and they are gathering medical supplies that I'm going to give to my representative in Sofia. And from there, they will be sent to Ukraine. So that's are the examples how it is organized, even on the such smaller personal level, in addition to governmental cooperation.
Can you imagine if you were in the US now, you could have gone back with a truck full of guns? Those guys have a lot of guns. You know, there's more guns than people in the US. Mm-hmm. We don't have guns.
Yeah.
So how can we help, actually? Medicine and what else?
Medicine first.
Medicine. What kind of medicine?
I'll send you a list.
Okay.
It's like it's a like dozen of different articles of things that are most needed that go directly to the... that goes directly to the first medical kit, yeah?
Okay.
So I'll give you the list. It will be attached to this video, yeah?
Yeah, we'll put it in the description.
Yes, that's a good one. Second is humanitarian aid. Here we are talking about everything that warms you up. Like now it's like easier, but thermal clothes is good. Tactical gloves. You can buy the tactical gloves. Tactical glasses would also work very well. All things that relate to children care, pampers, everything what you need for children, for example. Yes, all the type of hygiene, because so many people are moving around, and only in my city, in Lviv, there are 200,000 internally displaced people. So can you believe Lviv, the city of 800,000 people, and now a quarter of it extra, those are people who simply come to the city. So how big a pressure does it make to the local infrastructure and economy? And similar story is in every city and town in Western Ukraine. So there are so many people, like 10 million internally displaced, and they need food, they need hygiene, all this kind of like basic stuff, for people.
Even in big cities that are well organized for events, planned in advance with a great infrastructure, 200,000 people is a mess.
I must say that Lviv, being the biggest city in west of Ukraine, which started to serve as the main logistical hub of the country, starting from all the embassies moved there, the headquarters of organizations, and obviously people. Yes, so we received the biggest amount of people from the rest of Ukraine. We did pretty well because Lviv itself is pretty like Western oriented and organized city.
Yes.
You know, we have all the bike lanes and this urban planning model, you know, this kind of stuff. So even during the first days of the war, when it was messy everywhere, our city services were functioning properly. Yeah. Water, electricity, hotline was answering.
Sanitation, I've seen.
Sanitation, public transport was operating according to the schedule. You know, all these processes have been doing well. Numerous humanitarian centers have been opened and refugee facilities have been opened. So I would say Lviv handled it very well. It was on the edge, but we did a good job. Yeah.
What actually can an Ukrainian work these days? What kind of work can you do to sustain yourself? Because money are not falling out of the sky.
Yeah. So many millions of Ukrainians lost the job.
And how many millions?
I don't know. Like almost everybody I know financially suffered because of the war. Yeah.
Suffered or still suffers.
And I mean, it started, yeah. First of all, it's possible to look in different perspectives here. So first of all, Ukraine is a huge IT country, and same as Romania. Romania is also huge. So I think per capita, probably similarly involved into those areas. But because Ukraine is bigger, that's why it's the fourth country in Upwork, for example. Yes, and only in Lviv, there are over 30,000 people employed in IT outsourcing. So these people kept their job, they continue working, and they provide tremendous financial support. If, let's say, you are a small business owner, that very likely you lost your job. My personal example, for example, I am an established blogger in Ukraine, have a marketing agency, and lion's share of my personal business was coming from a project which was a membership platform, like an online membership platform for small entrepreneurs in Ukraine, where for the fee of 20 euro per month, which is recurring subscription revenue, we are providing a range of tools to our clients. You know, and I had a pool of hundreds of clients. So when the war broke up, a third of my clients had to flee or run or like internal display. So they were not thinking about work. A third of them had to, you know, like suffered in their own business along this chain. And third, you know, they could stay on the subscription, for example. They were still doing okay. But for me, continue operating this business lost any sense because now the entire focus is on war. Like, I cannot help with marketing campaign to this guy whose business is down, for example.
Okay.
So I simply opened the full access of my materials to a wider audience so they can use it in order to get some kind of job abroad. And this is the sign that we have to go from internal market to the global market. So on the side effect of this war, we see a tremendous integration of Ukraine into the global economy. Even though before the market of 44 million people was sustainable for many businesses.
Of course. Not so many people know that Ukraine was not just a functioning economy. It was thriving.
Yeah.
It was growing pretty fast. And Ukrainians were exporting a lot of IT services.
Oh, yeah.
I know a lot of Romanian companies that use Ukrainian workforce in the IT sector. So you guys are good at what you do. And there's many of you at what you do.
Absolutely.
So that means... This at this time of the year, because of this special operation thing, many people let's call it war.
Yeah,
what it is. So many people are displaced. They cannot do their work and they don't get paid. How long until it's becoming too rough?
I don't have these predictions. Yes, so it also. First of all, people cannot rely on governmental, welfare. Because even if it's 150, 200 euro, these prices are still going up. You're not going to sustain yourself in this. How long will it last? I don't know. But first of all, like getting online job is one of the ways for Ukrainians now to sustain their families. And since many Ukrainians are already... tech or marketing or let's see online savvy, they can do it. So this one, and otherwise, as I told, the entire economy is restructuring to the war needs, and unfortunately or fortunately, war is also money. So let's say if there was a bus driver traveling between Kharkiv and Poltava, and his line is not operating anymore, but he still has a bus. Now he is delivering goods from one place.
Or soldiers
and so on. You know, and he gets paid for this.
I hear that a trucker that goes to Ukraine and then to Europe to bring a truck full of wheat, let's say, that transport is paid at least 3 to 6 times better than it was a year ago.
It's absolutely possible.
And because some drivers are afraid, they say some parts of Ukraine are a jungle. That's the word I'm hearing.
Ukraine what?
It's like a jungle.
Jungle for them, because they don't know what's happening. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
it's like terra incognita. They're afraid, they don't want to go.
Yeah, the east mostly.
That's why you hire local Ukrainian drivers to do the job. For example, if there is somebody from Kharkiv, from Sumy, you better hire that truck driver to go to Lviv to pick up the tools from the Polish truck driver who will bring it to Lviv, because this person will go back to Sumy because his family is there and he knows the area. You know, sometimes the bridge is destroyed, you have to find another way. And I have friends who work in the logistics, and they told that there are many, many situations when the truck driver is reaching Kyiv and he's calling the office and telling, I'm not going further. I am afraid. I don't know what is there. And then the entire chain is destroyed and people in the village are not getting food. So that's why you need to hire these drivers locally, who know the area first.
How do you find them?
And who will definitely come back to their community. They need jobs. They will take whatever, yeah?
Are they on Upwork?
Not on Upwork, yeah. But this is the specialty of every industry, yes? And there you just do it. For example, even East Ukraine is terra incognita for me. But after I'm done with this trip on the Balkans, I'm coming to the East. Crew gets ready and we go to the East because it will put our own perspective on the field, what is actually happening. I will be able to feature this in my media materials, and we help those people somehow, yeah.
I'm following some Twitter accounts that are sharing a lot of information about the war. I'm trying to keep up with the information. There's a lot happening, so it's kind of hard to keep up. But some of the things I find heartbreaking, let's say, when I see good people that go to the front line to support the war effort, of course, but also... to represent their media companies or storytellers or bloggers or people that communicate to large communities. And some of them died there.
It's true. Since the start of the war, approximately a little bit over 30, I believe, journalists already died.
Yes.
You know, journalism is a profession. And I'm a journalist myself, actually.
Of course.
So in order to deliver the most truthful picture, sometimes you have to go to the very source of it.
Of course.
And if you are at the same place with the soldiers on the front line and you are unlucky to fall under the artillery attack, that's unfortunately what happens. A good friend of mine who was helping a foreign crew of journalists, he was in the situation when their car was shot near Irpin. He survived, but two journalists died. And that's the situation what is happening. For example, I traveled together to the north with very experienced journalist Rauli Virtanen from Finland. He's a very honorable man, being 73 years old, and he started his war reporting career all the way back in Vietnam in 72. Since then, he visited all possible military conflict in the last 50 years, including 13 times Afghanistan, Khmer regime in Cambodia, and so forth. Yeah, and I learned a lot from him, what to do, where to go, what not to do, and so on. Everybody has their limits and their barriers. Obviously, I will take the decision on the ground where you understand things much better than from here or from Lviv. Yeah.
But it's very important work, because some of the criticism of the situation in Ukraine comes from the fact that most of the information is one-sided. So it's what the Russians are saying, which is the same rhetoric. No one says anything mm-hmm. else. And from the Ukrainian side, where most of the communication is handled through the government, the Ukrainian armed forces, and the foreign minister, and that's kind of it. So most of the communication is centralized. Mm-hmm. Of course, during the war it is. But in order to gain the trust of your audience, it needs to be real. It needs to be collected by journalists.
Absolutely. Another thing to understand is that there are areas where journalists are simply not allowed by the army because of their life-threatening situation, or because the journalists are such kind of creatures that want now and everything to show. For example, I'm in touch with many journalists in Lviv. You know, they were gathering in Lviv and they were organizing to go out. Yeah, and let's say there was an attack in Lviv, like a refinery in Lviv was attacked, and one journalist is calling me and tell like, Oras, bring the car, let's go there and see what is like really happening there. I told him like, whoa, let's wait. Like, let's wait for the official governmental report, what really happened and so on, because this is one of the most crucial moments during the attack. If the missile is coming, they shoot something, you know? Then the military takes the area around and they, you know, try to put the fire down and so on. And if there is a journalist, 5 minutes after, he's filming and he's showing like, look, this is the refinery. They hit like only that barrel, but thankfully everything else is still standing. In 20 minutes, you have a next attack, which is destroying everything. And this situation that actually happened already, because of this, like, it's not coordinating, but because of this free flow of information at such crucial moments, they served as the tweaking for the second attack. That's why it's also very important to understand what you are doing. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's a very sensitive topic because this is the war. In this case, okay, you deliver the truth. You tell this is still standing, this is not. But you're also providing on the plate information for the enemy to hit that target.
Yes. But I'm looking at reports that say, what are actually they're trying to achieve? Because most of the places where they are succeeding, and gaining rubble. The Russians mm-hmm. actually are victorious over a piece of rubble in mm-hmm. the end. Mm-hmm. So the Ukrainians are fighting back so hard that the only way that Russians can push them out is by destroying everything, scorched earth strategy.
I am afraid that this is the strategy to burn the land, to free up the land in the way that people would not be able to come back, and to resettle this with the, your own people. And these are the strategies that not unheard of in the history. Those are very cruel ways, but it's a cleansing. It's an ethnical cleansing at the moment, unfortunately.
What? We were getting ready to claim the end of history. No mm-hmm. more wars.
Well, it's, I know what you're thinking about. Like, we are living in 21st century, how this can happen. You know, civilized society with free flow of information. But that's the reality, what is happening now, and everybody's witnessing it. People tell, never repeat again, and so on. But if you think of it, during the 30s of the 20th century, German society was one of the most advanced in the world.
Yes.
With all the physicians, scientists, you know, these amazing autobahns built all around Germany. And somehow they managed to brainwash such a large group of people to simply exterminate another. And at this very moment, we reached the level of, you know, internet and free flow of information and crypto and so on. But still, you see that 80% of society support one crazy guy.
You're talking about Russia.
Yes. And they are like ready to simply burn the land to conquer it. Like, it doesn't fall into our heads. But unfortunately, this is the reality what we are facing now.
And they even go further than this and threaten the entire world that if they step in, they're going to show them the Sarmat missile, which is going to be ready by before the year's end. Which I just heard, I read a statement from Putin just the other day.
That's crazy. That's crazy. And
but is it? Because the guy has been very consistent at his plan. Yeah, he kept at it. The democracies and the Western world changed presidents, had revolutions and everything else. He kept at his plan. He was very consistent with his plan. And now I even hear that they are issuing USSR passports to the liberated people in the Donetsk and Lugansk.
This is unfortunately the situation when the opponent, when the Russian Federation, Putin himself, and many people who support him, they will accept and understand only one language. And unfortunately, this is the language of brutal power. Like, there is no way around it at the moment. And we've seen it with the sanctions, we've seen it with all these limitations, with negotiatings. You know, when the foreign minister of Russia on the open interview is telling we didn't invade Ukraine, like, what else can you answer?
It's a special operation.
Yeah. There are Russian troops in Ukraine. Why did you invade it? We did not invade Ukraine.
If he looks you in the eye and he says that, we are living in the post-truth era.
It's something like that, yeah.
If you say a lie enough times, it becomes some sort of reality.
Mm-hmm. And there is a one modern Russian philosopher that questions the modern paradigm. He told that, I forgot his name, he's the guy with the long beard.
Yes, everybody's talking about that guy.
Yeah,
Let's not mention his name.
Yes, that he formed the modern geopolitical view of Russia is that there can be different truth. But that means that you have to look for the essence here, right? And
death is real. There's no two truths about death. You are dead or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
You are free or you're not. Yes?
Yes.
So it's not that simple. There is not multiple truths to that. Suffering is real.
Yeah, and this actually war is... this war is like one of the unique examples in the history when it's actually so clear, you know, because there were many military conflicts. You don't really understand who against whom. This is here is clear. There is Russian army in Ukraine killing people. it's like black and white. One country aggressively invaded another country.
And when they liberate, they put Lenin statues.
That's why the entire world, also uniquely in the history, is so united in voting, in taking precautions.
With
so
a
on.
Few exceptions.
This is unique situation when there are only four countries who support another against of 100 plus.
Yes.
And so this, what we are witnessing now, is a historical moment with the same significance that our grandparents were living through. And now, like...
We're going to tell stories to our nephews about this.
Yeah.
Our grandchildren will hear about this and going to say, oh my God, you guys were crazy back then.
Mm-hmm.
And we are looking at our grandparents that witnessed the Second World War and say, come on, those are crazy times.
That was crazy, yeah.
But I'm going to push it one step further. Mm-hmm. You said 80%, 4 out of 5 Russians support the government. Are they? Or are just afraid? Are they really supporting the government? Are they brainwashed? Or are they afraid?
First of all, we have the facts of voting. And international society doesn't question the result of voting. Obviously, they question the foreign policy of the government, but they don't question the result of the voting. So we assume that the population really vote for Единая Россия, for Putin. Obviously, there are people who don't support or who are against. And those people are leaving.
Hundreds of thousands of Russians are leaving.
So far, over 4 million Russians left Russia.
4 million?
Yes.
Are you sure about that?
Yes. We can see the numbers, but it's a lot of people. Yeah, like
okay.
Since the recent years, let's say 17, when they start to suppress the
They're
protests.
Talking about a huge brain drain, but yeah. 4 million is more than that.
It's a lot. Russia
it's
is a huge country.
Cities. It's...
Yeah. Yeah, Russia is 144 million population, huge country as well.
Okay.
So 4 million is like what?
2.5%?
Yeah. Then there are people who are afraid and they simply keep silence. Then there are people who don't care. And then there is a majority who is fed with this glory and belonging to something great and support the current movement. So we understand that in addition to the foreign pressure that is happening, the game changer can be the internal revolution in Russia. Yes.
Okay.
Russia was going through the revolution in 1917.
Okay, yes.
In 1917. So it is possible. I'm not the political expert on the situation in Russia, but what I hear from my friends who left Russia or from interviews, politicians, dissidents and so on, they tell that at the current state, within a decade, the internal revolution is not possible in Russia.
It's not.
That's what I hear. That's what
because
I see.
It's exactly what we see.
Yeah.
Although Russia is not evolving technologically, it's just living off oil, mostly iron and all kind of raw material. Mm-hmm. It's not, I don't have anything made in Russia that is worth mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basic. If you think about, okay, what do I have that I bought that was made in Russia when it was so good? So it's not let's say, a major industry, but it's still... It's still working, let's say.
Mm-hmm. That's something what we in Western societies cannot actually understand.
Yes.
Yeah? That's what we cannot understand. But
what? How do you keep it relevant?
The majority of your huge population is distant from the centers of economy like Moscow or St. Petersburg. It is impoverished and it has... only a limited sources of information. If you live in this reality and you never traveled abroad and you didn't see the alternative, then you believe in this truth.
Yes,
and
but
you keep...
Don't they become even poorer?
Definitely at the moment with all the sanctions, the economy of the country is rolling back to the 70s or 60s. So
is it because the ruble now is much stronger than before the war?
Yeah, but ruble is not the all the companies. It's not McDonald's, which withdrew from Russian Federation.
There and, is and not, there is that crazy guy that took over and he restarted McDonald's with a different name.
Yeah,
so eventually it's gonna work. So the ruble now it's actually much stronger. And I'm looking at the charts. It's much better than the dollar. It was from January, let's say.
I have no answer to this. This is probably you have to invite somebody from the global economics to talk about this. That's actually very interesting how things turn upside down eventually. Yes. And, you know, the entire world is thinking what step to do next.
So it seems like not only the Ukrainians can take some pain, but also the Russians.
Oh, absolutely.
They can.
Yeah. And that's one of the tools to push on the situation.
Okay, your time is limited. I know you need to go ahead on your schedule, and I'm really grateful for you taking the time to come and talk. I just feel like we just barely scratched the surface.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to introduce in the description your socials so people can follow you and watch your work. And also, I'm going to introduce some resources for people that want to donate or support in any way. Mm. We've been following this for the past more than a year and a half, and it's evolving before our eyes, but I feel more than ever we need voices that are out there. So when you're going to the East, we need to keep in touch and maybe we can talk again.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting. Thanks for providing this amazing platform to spread information and deliver it to your followers. And I wish you good luck. And we keep in touch because this process is ongoing.
Thank you, Orest.
My pleasure.
So that was Orest Zub, one of the vloggers from Ukraine that is now in Romania to share his story. If you want to support also the cause, as you heard, go down in the description and follow any of the links that you might feel that you can, use to help. And that's going to be about it. I'm really grateful that you've listened to this English podcast between a Romanian and Ukrainian. Hope it works, lingua franca.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is what it is. It's the word, but we need to pay attention to it because it's not going anywhere soon. And the end of the year is going to be even rougher than this. So pay attention. That's a very important currency during a war. Enough for this episode. I'm going to kindly ask you now to like, share, and subscribe, and we'll see you for the next one.